This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, the spotlight falls yet again on PNG's prison system and inmates on remand as 11 are shot dead during a jailbreak in Lae. We take a look at how impacts of COVID-19 will increase the burden on young islanders in the aftermath of the pandemic. And have you ever wondered which part of the world has the richest biodiversity? Look no further than New Guinea Island. Those stories to come later in the programme, but first, the geopolitical debate about China's rising influence in the Pacific has been reignited by a photo apparently showing the Chinese ambassador to Kiribati walking on the backs of a group of young men lying prostrate on the ground. The ambassador, Tang Songgen, who took up his post earlier this year, several months after Kiribati switched its diplomatic alliance from Taiwan to China, was photographed taking part in a traditional welcome ceremony, and the image has gone viral on social media. As Jordan Fennell reports, it's prompted senior foreign diplomats and politicians, including some here in Australia, to weigh in, as well as prompting a debate among the Kiribati people themselves, with some saying that a cultural practice has been taken out of context.
They say a picture tells a thousand words. And ever since this photo appeared in various Facebook groups and on Twitter, hundreds of social media users have tried to depict the story that it's telling. It shows around 30 people, all who appear to be males, lying on the ground on their stomachs in a field next to an airplane. A man who's said to be the new Chinese ambassador to Kiribati, Tang Songgen, is walking on their backs as two women on either side of him hold his hands to steady him. It's said to be on the small island of Marrakech in Kiribati as part of a welcoming ceremony for the ambassador.
When I first saw the post on Facebook, one of my immediate comments was, what a beautiful Kiribati culture.
Ray Buntace is an e-Kiribati man living in New Zealand whose grandmother is from the Marrakech Island. He says he has no issue with what the photo shows, but says he understands why there has been backlash.
It might be misinterpreted by other people depending on how they see the photo, because the initial poster did not put background information so that, you know, they put more context into what was happening at the time.
But it is unclear who took the photo or who posted it to social media. Ray Buntace says he saw that particular cultural practice as a child at family weddings, an explanation several others have also given.
The groom side, you know, kind of lay on the floor to allow the in-laws walk on them to show that, you know, they're happy and welcome as part of the family.
But not everyone feels the same about the photo. Ramon is a freelance journalist in Kiribati who says that some locals he's come across are not happy.
People are angry about it. They are upset. They are embarrassed. But even in the street, a random guy on the street, and I told him about it, and he was actually very disgusted about it. And he said this is not appropriate for someone to allow someone to do that.
The photo has emerged while there are still fresh feelings in the country over its switch in diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China last September, leaving Taiwan with just 15 diplomatic allies around the world. Ramon, who's worked with Kiribati's former president, Anote Tong, says he has never seen a Taiwanese ambassador welcomed in the same way during his time in politics.
There has been a number of Taiwan ambassadors who have served Kiribati in the past, who have visited the same island. And I am not aware that those ambassadors were accorded such welcome ceremony.
Even foreign politicians and officials have weighed in. Konstantin Panayuto, the US defense attaché to five Pacific islands, including Kiribati, wrote on Twitter, "I simply cannot imagine any scenario in which walking on the backs of children is acceptable behavior by an ambassador of any country, or any adult for that matter. Yet here we are, thanks to China's ambassador to Kiribati." While Australian politician Dave Sharma, who spent time as a diplomat in PNG, asked on Twitter, "Is this for real?" And he told the ABC, quote, "I'd be very surprised if an Australian representative participated in such a ceremony of this nature." Ramon says that even at home, the geopolitics of the image is not going unnoticed.
But outside of it, actually in the region, they see this. And with the current landscape, political landscape with China in the region and the West and all that, and then you see a Chinese ambassador stepping on speak, literally. What's they doing is that?
But Ray Buntes says the viewpoint of the people from Marrakech Island is the one that matters the most in this conversation.
The global audience are kind of, you know, having that opinion, which is tied to politics, which is tied to Taiwan and China. But in fact, if you stand in a point of being neutral and kind of get the cultural lens on, I think that will really help you kind of understand what's happening. Because for me, like, I feel that that was done out of love and respect. They're just doing that to offer that cultural way of, you know, saying that you are welcome on the island.
I spoke with Ruateki Takaira, the environment minister, who is also MP for Marrakech Island. Minister Takaira was there on the island with the ambassador when the event took place.
This is the culture from the island, very unique culture of the island. No one can oppose this. When the elders decide this, no one from the island can face this. Because this tradition from the elders, if anyone come to the island, they will be discussed from among the elders and what they will do in terms of welcoming him or her when he or she arrives. And this is it's the very highest point of respect to signify the true love.
The Chinese embassy in Kiribati has a Facebook page, and Ambassador Teng Song Gen wrote that he had visited Marrakech Island and other outer islands at the invitation of different island councils and MPs. He also wrote that the visits were educational in purpose and that he was warmly welcomed by the locals and greeted in traditional courtesies. He did not directly address the photo and the controversy surrounding it. He wrote that he was really overwhelmed by the unique culture and the hospitality.
Jordan Fennell with that report. Now, not for the first time, the prison system in Papua New Guinea is under scrutiny after a jailbreak during which nearly a dozen inmates were fatally shot while more than 30 managed to get away. Human rights advocates have long argued that a root cause of PNG's frequent jailbreaks is the fact that many of those behind bars have spent months and sometimes years on remand without ever setting foot in a court. And this time, as Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby, the prison's minister is echoing those concerns and promising a major shake-up.
Authorities say 47 prisoners at the Buimoh jail busted out of prison. 11 of them are dead. Lay Metropolitan Commander Chris Kunyan Ban told local TV station MTV that police allege the escape was planned by detainees on remand, waiting for their day in court.
They pretended that someone was sick. They took him over to the post and they attacked the CS officers with knives and slingshot, and they dashed for freedom.
PNG's Correctional Service Commissioner Stephen Pokanis alleges police and prison officers shot the prisoners during the breakout.
So there is always police sector patrol that is roving around that area. So when the escape took place, they were called in within minutes, and the team, along with CS officers, pursued the prisoners up to the hills, and this is where prisoners were shot.
But Lay Metropolitan Commander Chris Kunyan Ban wouldn't confirm how the man had died.
That's for the coroner to determine the cause of the death.
Australian Director of Human Rights Watch Elaine Pearson says the allegations of the shooting must be investigated.
Well, this is not the first time that prisoners have been killed during an escape at this prison in Lae. Papua New Guinea authorities really need to investigate the prison break, and they need to hold those accountable who used unnecessary or excessive force.
Commissioner Pokani says investigations will be carried out into the incident, but he says authorities are limited in how they can respond to mass breakouts.
Once they escape out from the main compound, and that's where there are a number of fences, prisoners are called to stop. There is what we call the small dog track fence, and then outside there is another big perimeter fence, which is I think about 5 meters or so above. And once they leave this and they are out of the institution, this is where officers resort to using firearms.
This is the latest in a series of jailbreaks that have happened right across PNG. Many others have also had deadly endings. Stephen Pokani says the underlying issues are complex and multifaceted.
It is a legacy issue. All these jails were set up back in the late 60s and 70s. And it is not only the correctional service we are struggling. It is through the entire government services. You're talking about health, education, so on.
The fear of coronavirus being brought in is another added issue right now. Elaine Pearson says the government must look into the well-being of prisoners.
It is now a potentially dangerous situation as well, and there is inadequate staffing. So, you know, we really need the PNG government both to investigate what occurred with all of these people being killed, but also the PNG government needs to provide adequate medical care to people in prison.
But there's also consensus on what one of the major problems is. Many of PNG's prisoners haven't actually been convicted despite being behind bars, often for years without having their time in court. This time, officials say 37 of the escapees were remandees. Corrections Commissioner Stephen Pokanis admits that some of the men were waiting for more than 10 years, so they decided to make a run for it.
Prisoners are now well-educated, and they know the rule of law. They know when justice is done, and when justice is done fairly, and when justice is not done fairly. So.
And the minister responsible for PNG's prison system agrees. In a strongly worded statement, Minister Chris Nongoy said, the uncertainty caused by the system was impacting on detainees' mental health. He is proposing a major shake-up of the system, including suggesting that major prisons should have their own courthouses on site. The minister was also scathing of police, questioning the skills of police prosecutors, and he suggested prisoners without complete court files should not be accepted unless they're accused of murder and rape. But PNG has been here before, and it's been accused many times of promising investigations into deadly jailbreaks. And for people like Elaine Pearson, this latest incident is just a case of deja vu.
To date, I don't think we are aware of any officers being prosecuted for past killings of escapees. There were 17 prison escapees in 2017, four in 2018 from this same prison. And, you know, I think this is really an indication. Prisons in Papua New Guinea, particularly this prison, is already stretched to breaking point. It's basically bursting at the seams from overcrowding.
Elaine Pearson, the Australian Director of Human Rights Watch, ending that report from Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Measured in terms of the impact on public health, the worst effects of COVID-19 have fallen predominantly on the older members of society. But in the long term, it will be the younger generations who have to bear the full social consequences of the global pandemic. This is especially true in the Pacific, where population research has identified a youth bulge. And as Nick Fogarty reports, existing challenges already confronting young islanders will only be magnified by the coronavirus, with massive disruption to education and employment prospects in particular.
I have a question. It's a little hard to ask.
When she's not wowing audiences with her music, 22-year-old Tongan Mia Kami studies law and politics at the University of the South Pacific. She's currently in Fiji, but COVID-19 border closures mean her mum and sister are stuck in Tonga, while her grandmother is stuck in New Zealand.
Not being able to see close family members, especially in case of emergency, is really difficult. And then it was also difficult in the past couple months with my studies. I'm sure a lot of people understand this as well. Fiji had gone on lockdown and my university was forced to go online as well. And online teaching isn't easy for everyone.
Mia Kami is one of the under 23-year-olds who make up half the population of the Pacific Island region. New research from the Lowy Institute has identified a youth bulge, with the proportion of young people continuing to expand. Catherine Wilson is the author of the Lowy Institute paper.
That is going to have enormous impact on future prospects for young people in the region, given that many countries are still developing countries. They have slow-growing economies, very high unemployment. There is also a range of health issues from non-communicable diseases, and there is also deficit in particular and high unemployment, and also challenges in raising educational attainment at the secondary level and above.
Now COVID-19 has brought the issues attached to the youth bulge into even sharper focus.
So what COVID-19 has done really has just raised the level of urgency of this issue and made it really, I think, more of a frontline issue that we need to be thinking about, because COVID-19, with its economic impact, the economic downturn which is occurring globally and will affect the region as well, and also this, the greatest struggle children and young Pacific Islanders will now have to finish their education and indeed continue an uninterrupted education, and of course the fact that jobs are likely to be impacted, economic opportunities will be much greater impacted by COVID-19, means that those issues in particular are going to become just more urgent.
In terms of education, COVID has forced young students across the world to move out of the physical classroom and into online teaching. In countries like Papua New Guinea, where there's been steady growth in infection numbers over the last couple of weeks, some children live in incredibly remote areas with little access to technology. This means online learning is out of reach. Dr. Kilala Devet Chi is Senior Research Fellow in Education at the PNG National Research Institute, and she says it's a concern.
It's going to be really difficult. We have seen it. We have just gone through it, and it has been very difficult for students to access, to go through what we call remote learning. So even on the radios, there are radio programs, but not everyone can access the radio, simply because there are some provinces that do not have radio stations.
And for older high school children especially, even small disruptions now can have big ramifications for their long-term future.
When we put all the lockdowns, the two lockdowns and the SOV together, it comes to a total of 9 weeks that have been lost, 9 weeks of learning. In a term, we have 10 weeks. As a consequence of that, definitely children who are examining grades, which is grade, especially grade 12, who are ready to go to tertiary institutions, that will then have a big impact on their GPAs for entry into the tertiary institutions.
Savendra Michael is Fijian, but he's pursuing a PhD in development studies at the University of Auckland. Because of border closures, he's now stuck back in Fiji, which has upset both his studies and his work prospects.
So I was so depressed with the fact that I was so close to finishing my PhD and I couldn't go back because of this pandemic and the borders closing and so forth. And here is me being in this space because I was hoping to finish and come back and apply for one of those expat roles so that I can actually give back.
This week, the International Labour Organization released research on the COVID-19 youth employment crisis in Asia and the Pacific, which shows that nearly half of young workers in the region are employed in the four sectors hit hardest by the crisis. In Fiji, the ILO predicts youth unemployment rates are expected to reach at least double the 2019 estimates, even if COVID-19 is contained quickly. Savendra Michael has been affected, and so have his siblings, who work in a different sector.
My siblings, they are residing in the village, and they used to rely on the sale of their local produce. But with the trade market being affected so drastically and locals realizing the importance of investing in subsistence agriculture, they are just trying to make ends meet by doing the same what everyone else is doing, right? Just by looking at their subsistence first, and then they're looking at whatever is left, if they can sell it, because it's all going to go at below cost price as well.
Every week, there are promising noises about new vaccines that might lead the world out of the COVID-19 pandemic. But in the meantime, young people such as Mia Kami, Savendra Michael and the rest of the youth bulge are being asked to sit tight, despite the massive disruption. And as the Lowy Institute notes, with past conflicts in Bougainville and Solomon Islands being prompted by frustrations with weak governance and inequality, those in power will be hoping that the region's youth feel like they're being listened to.
Time to start healing, healing from the hurt.
Time to music there by Mia Kami, recorded by Fiji's legend FM, and the reporter was Nick Fogarty. And finally, for this edition of Pacific Review, the island of New Guinea can lay claim to being a world record holder after a team of 99 scientists reached the conclusion that it has the richest flora on the planet. And now, as Jordan Fennell reports, the hope is there will be a far greater emphasis on conserving that region's biodiversity in the face of threats from logging and population growth.
For centuries, scientists have been trying to record all the plants that live in the dense jungles of New Guinea.
They have the most amazing flowers. Their flowers are beautiful and stunning, and the fruits are often big, red, juicy, sort of a fleshy fruit, a bit like a tomato type looking thing, I think. It's really, really stunning.
Barry Conn is a retired Australian botanist who has spent decades studying the trees on the island of New Guinea, which is actually the second largest island in the world, taking in both the mainland of Papua New Guinea and Indonesia's Papua and West Papua provinces.
In Papua New Guinea, in some parts there, you've got what we call the underlayer, the understory of trees, which is a forest in itself, is sort of like 30 metres high. Then towering above that, going right through that to 60 metres are these trees. And you just got to look at them and go, wow, they are just absolutely amazing.
In 2018, he was invited to work with 99 other scientists from around the globe in an attempt to create the first expert-verified checklist of all the island's flora. The scientists spent almost a year trawling through lists of over 700,000 specimens of plants, with some of the data dating back to the 17th century.
The combination of quite a bit of computing work, but quite a bit of library work, but mostly looking at specimens and trying to make sure that we did actually have those species in New Guinea region. So when the first request went out, till it was closed off was about 8 months.
And the time-consuming effort paid off. They found that New Guinea is the most plant-rich island on Earth, with more than 13,500 species of plants, 13,634 to be exact. 68% of those species are only found in New Guinea, which is unmatched in tropical Asia.
You look at the forest and you're looking at these dense, wet tropical forests, and they really dense. They have the flora there. You've got the different species of trees, and then in these trees you've got from the ground layer, you've got mosses and liverworts, and as you work your way up you get all the epiphytes and vines and lianas and things. Then you get, you know, maybe 30, 40, whatever, or more orchids on these trees. So it's a whole flora on every tree, not only just in the forest.
But while there were 99 scientists involved in the research, just 4 were from Papua New Guinea and only 1 from Indonesia. Osea Gideon from the University of Technology in PNG's second largest city of Leh was one of them.
This is information that we can use with some degree of confidence. In the past, we estimate flora of Papua New Guinea has 9,000 species, some say it's 20,000 species, even 25,000 species. With this publication, at least we've got something that we can, say with some confidence.
He says their findings are incredibly important in the fight to promote conservation efforts in PNG. A University of PNG State of the Forest report in 2014 found that 24% of primary rainforest ecosystems have been lost since 1972, mostly because of industrial logging. People like Osea Gideon have long worried that logging has meant some species were at risk of being wiped out before the world even knew they existed.
I hope that with this kind of news all over the world that New Guinea is the richest flora in the world, I hope that our government will be able to see this and we can seriously look at ways that we can set realistic targets about conservation of flora, conservation of biodiversity generally in the country.
Barry Conn agrees that the findings are very significant.
These lists firstly generate enthusiasm about New Guinea, and so this is really a stunning place for plants, but it also gives all the policy makers in government and non-government areas more information to hopefully make their decisions about how they actually manage their landscape.
But Mr. Conn describes the fact that just 5 of the researchers were from the New Guinea region is a weakness.
One of the reasons we wrote this paper was to try and get attention back to New Guinea so that we can get within country organisations, institutions like universities and the government and other non-government agencies to actually start thinking about this, how rich their flora is, and actually putting money and resources into getting more people producing research.
Botanist Barry Conn ending that report from Jordan Fennell and rounding up this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart, and please do join me again next time for more of the big stories from around the Pacific Islands.